This is the Mike Rosen Show on News Radio 850 KOA.
5 minutes after 10 o'clock, I'm John Caldera. Glad you could spend some time with me. Telephone number here is 303-713-8585. I know that we've been hitting what looks like to be a pretty substantial recession. It's going to be tough. And there are a lot of calls for government action. We're seeing more and more bailouts. If you add up all the bailouts, Bloomberg put together a total of about $7 trillion that American taxpayers are on the hook. Work this out, it comes out to about $24,000 for every man, woman, and child. That's what we potentially are on the hook for with all these bailouts. And I remember going to school, learning about FDR and how he saved us from the Great Depression. I'm getting rumors about how Obama is going to save us from this as well. So I wanted to introduce a friend of mine, but don't hold that against him. Larry Reed, who runs the Foundation for Economic Education, also the founder of the Mackinac Center out in Michigan, and for a long time a big fan, or I don't know fan, but a scholar of the Great Depression. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, John.
Now, you've made this more of a intellectual and academic hobby following what happened during the Great Depression, what really caused it, and this simple question, did FDR make it better or make it worse?
Worse.
What was your fascination with this, first of all?
Well, I think it's one of the most compelling episodes in American economic history and just fraught with lessons for the present day. You can hardly talk about the Great Depression without drawing parallels and considering the kind of measures we'd want to take to avoid going through something like that again. And, it's just a hugely important chapter in American history.
Now, when we say depression, when we say the depression, we think of one depression. But in fact, America has gone through several depressions. What is a depression? How many of them have we had?
Well, I've lost count, but I have to tell you that we've had at least half a dozen in American history, and that's not counting the recessions, the milder downturns, but full-blown depressions, at least a dozen. The interesting thing about the one of the 1930s is that it lasted about three times longer than any of the previous depressions in American history.
So when we've had depressions, several quarters in a row of negative economic growth, they've lasted on average how long?
Oh, let's see. If you're
roughly speaking,
if you're throwing in both recessions and depressions, then you're talking about two different animals. But I would say on average 2 years.
Okay, for a depression. The Great Depression, being great, it was what, 12 years?
Yeah, 12 years, from 1929 to 1941. The longest depression in American history before that time was the one that began in 1893, and it lasted about 3.5 years. So, yeah, this was a great depression in the 30s, not only because of its depth, it was very deep, deepest that we've had, but also by far the longest.
Now, my memory of how I was taught this, I think most people hold the following view of FDR and the Great Depression, which was we had this terrible depression. It was brought on by runaway spending and people using money they didn't have in the 1920s. It came crashing down in 1929, and it was FDR who used such great programs to keep us going during this terrible period. If not for FDR doing these, the National Recovery Act and doing these other programs that kept people working, kept people building bridges and building roads and digging ditches, we would not have survived. A personal story of my grandparents. When alive, a couple of them were the diehard Democrats. Why? Because Roosevelt kept them working during the Depression, and if not for them, the whole country would have gone to hell. If not for FDR, we might have turned into a communist country. So God bless FDR. God bless what he was able to do to bring us work during this terrible time.
Well, that's unfortunately been conventional wisdom or some version thereof for many decades. But I have to say it's just full of errors, mistakes, and propaganda. Nothing could be further from the truth, frankly. And when you look back at the track record, you'll find that statistics available to anybody clearly indicate that 8 years after Roosevelt started, two full terms in office, we were still very deep in depression. And in fact, in 1937, which is what, 4 years after he first took office, he achieved a first in American history, a depression within a depression. He took unemployment from around 15% back up over 20% in one of the swiftest collapses in American economic history. And that's in the middle of the Great Depression, 1937, with Roosevelt already having been in office for a full term.
Well, give me a couple of specifics. You assert that FDR made this depression much worse, took what a depression which would have lasted on average a couple of years and added an extra decade to it. What specifically did he do? What type of things did he do that you think extended the depression?
Well, let me point out, John, first of all, that we shouldn't let Herbert Hoover off the hook either, because he did some things in his term before Roosevelt took office that took us from a recession and made it a depression. But then when Roosevelt came in office, he did exactly the opposite of what he had promised. In the 1932 campaign, he attacked Herbert Hoover, rightly, for claiming that he was taking the country down the road to socialism. He had dramatically increased federal spending, raised taxes, and raised tariffs. And he promised that if elected, in fact, this was in the Democratic Party platform of 1932, that he would cut federal spending by 25%. But he did nothing of the kind. He took office and immediately raised spending, began raising taxes to all-time highs. In 1933, he secured the passage of two very destructive pieces of legislation, the National Industrial Recovery Act and the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which took us to sky-high unemployment. And what saved us from that was not FDR, but the Supreme Court, when they threw those things out a few years later.
Let me get back to this and see if I can draw a parallel. You talked about Hoover and then Roosevelt with unprecedented spending growth in government, and that FDR said he was going to reduce spending when, in fact, he massively increased spending. I'm taking a look at George Bush, who has now increased the size of government, even outside of military spending, to levels that we have not seen since Lyndon Baines Johnson. And we've now got a president-elect who has promised to do even more of that, that he wants to increase taxes, or he says that we're all going to get a tax cut except the top 5%, but those 5% are going to get killed with taxes. And he wants to spend, he's put out over the weekend his economic recovery proposal, which is still very vague, except one item, which was it's going to be huge. Is there a parallel between what Hoover / FDR did and what Bush, Obama are doing now?
Well, Obama's moving in the same direction, at least in terms of his rhetoric so far, as Roosevelt did. Dramatic increases in spending. He's been talking about tax hikes. This idea that he's only going to raise taxes on 5% and give 95% a tax cut is utterly ridiculous. He'll probably end up doing something akin to what Roosevelt did, which is raising taxes on virtually everybody. And by raising the top income tax bracket, as Roosevelt did, he will only send a strong negative message to people who have the wherewithal to reinvest in a bad economy. So, yeah, I see a lot of parallels.
Help me understand this part, Larry, which is, how is it that FDR, by increasing spending, made the depression work? Didn't he use that money in a rather Keynesian way to jumpstart the economy, to put people back to work, to get factories moving again, to get people building bridges and building roads, just as Obama said he wants to do? How did that prolong a depression? It seems to me that he was working to end a depression, to get us through a depression.
Well, government doesn't have a pot of money out there that it can just draw from out of the blue. Every penny that it spends comes from somebody, either from tax revenues on somebody, or by going more deeply into debt and mortgaging the next generation. So it's not as though government spending is some magic stimulus. And in fact, Roosevelt, in order to pay for some of that spending, had to raise taxes substantially on the American people. And if all you do is look at where government spends, work projects and public monuments and whatever, then you might be led to believe that because you're looking at that spending, that only good things happen. But you've got to ask yourself, where is it coming from? At whose expense? And we rarely do that. We look at only what strikes the eye. A good example would be, imagine a thief who goes door to door, grabbing all the loot that he can from various homes. He runs off to the shopping mall and spends it. If all you did was interview the storekeepers at the shopping mall, they're all going to say, hey, this guy stimulated my economy. I hope he comes back and does it again. But you would be ignoring the bigger picture, which is the spending that's not happening because funds have simply been diverted to politicians.
When why is it that FDR is credited with getting us through this Great Depression, steering us, leading us? And here's a guy who was a terrific orator, a great communicator, very articulate. He had his fireside chats. Right now, Obama now has given 4 press conferences since being elected, which is a record high for any president-elect. He's got an incredibly captive audience when it comes to the media. I see a lot of similarities when it comes to the style of communication. Why is it that FDR is credited with saving us, with helping us through this instead of making it worse?
Well, one of the reasons for that, John, you've actually sort of indirectly cited, and that is his oratory. He gave wonderful speeches, fireside chats. He convinced the American people that he was doing something. In fact, I think it was Will Rogers, the great humorist, who said that at the time the American people were so eager for something to be done that they would have applauded the burning down of the Capitol if it had been sold as an economic stimulus package. So the American people saw an activist president always giving great speeches, assuring them he was trying everything he could, and that carried a lot of water with people for a time. But another reason why he gets so much credit where very little credit is deserved is the way historians have written about the period. The bulk of historians believe that a good president is one who pushes the envelope of state power, who expands bureaucracy, who intrudes ever more into our lives, commands the economy, takes charge, in other words. And the FDR seemed to be doing that. A president who sort of stands back and allows an economy to heal and not do more damage by further intervention is written off by most historians as a do-nothing type president. So there's a natural bias in the way we write about these episodes in favor of government power, even if it doesn't work.
303-713-8585 is our telephone number. Larry Reed from the Foundation for Economic Education. And the reason I asked Larry on was to better understand, and I want to get into a little of the detail of the actions that FDR took in raising taxes, raising spending. I also want to talk to you about tariffs and trade. He was big on what I think we would call more isolation, at least economically speaking, how that made us worse in the Great Depression. The reason I wanted Larry here is because I feel, and maybe I'm wrong, tell me if I am, some incredible parallels from what happened then to what's happening now. 303-713-8585. In for Mike Rosen, I'm John Caldera. It's 22 minutes after 10 o'clock. Good morning. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm John Caldera. Give me a call, 303-713-8585. Larry Reed from the Foundation for Economic and Education, who's just done some great scholarly work on the Great Depression. What you're suggesting here, Larry, is that the sun rises in the West. We have been taught, we've been indoctrinated that FDR, through his many great charitable works, so we put it that way, great works of getting government to help us, have actually stayed off communism. That if it wasn't for FDR, the country would have been in worse shape economically. How could that not be true? Let me be more specific. Didn't FDR help push socialism away from America? There was a push towards communism in the early 30s.
Well, a lot of people think that because he didn't nationalize industries, he simply regulated them, that he somehow saved capitalism and avoided the country going in a far more socialist direction. But as a matter of fact, he set such dangerous precedents for the economy that government power in the decades since has only grown, for the most part. So he didn't really save capitalism at all. He prolonged the Depression and set dangerous precedents for massive government intervention, gave us programs that today are part of the reason why we've got an $11 trillion national debt.
Let's grab a couple of these phone calls as they're stacking up. 303-713-8585. In Westminster, John, you're on News Radio 850 KOA.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I'm a kind of a child of the Depression. I've been born in 1924, and my take on Franklin Delano Roosevelt is that we came out of the Depression in spite of him, and I also will postulate that he was probably the best wartime president we ever had. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt created all these programs that Obama is talking about today, building, rebuilding infrastructure and things like that. So he was the guy that started the CCCs, Civilian Conservation Corps, you know, the NRA.
And by the way, not the good NRA that allows me to keep and bear arms, but the bad NRA that did a lot of public works projects. When I talk to older folks, a lot of them speak adoringly of FDR. One of my older neighbors, he said, when I was a kid, I went up to Wyoming and I was part of the, I think it was the CCC.
Yes,
and we built trails and I got paid a dollar a day or something like that. And I was able to send it back a dollar. You know, I was able to send it back to my mom back in the city who used it to live. And without FDR, that wouldn't have happened. And that romance that we have of that government intervention and government providing jobs and taking over and regulating large parts of our economy, there is a romanticism that's what helped individuals through the Depression.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's only part of the story. People need to understand that if he hadn't been doing the other things that kept us in depression, then the need for those programs would have been much, much less.
I'm going to push you on this one more time, Larry. When you say the things that kept us in a depression, was it just raising taxes, just raising spending, or was it more?
Oh, no. The regulations of the period, the National Industrial Recovery Act in particular, was devastatingly harmful. It dramatically raised the cost of doing business about 40% across the board.
How so?
Well, it decreed price controls, and it raised prices. In fact, in a famous case, there was a tailor in the city of New York who was fined under the NRA for pressing a suit of clothes for 35 cents instead of the mandated price of 40 cents because FDR was trying to get prices up. And anybody who cut their prices, at a time of depression when people could hardly buy things to begin with, they were the ones who were prosecuted.
And this, by the way, is not a Republican/Democrat issue. Had the same sort of silliness under Richard Nixon with wage and price controls. I would argue we have the same ridiculousness when our president, current president, has outlawed incandescent light bulbs. The same sort of micromanagement that FDR really pioneered.
That's right.
Amen.
When it comes to agriculture, the AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933, levied a new tax on agriculture and then used the money to supervise the destruction of perfectly good fields of corn and wheat and other crops and the destruction of perfectly healthy cattle, sheep, and pigs, all in an effort to reduce the supply and raise the price. Scholars of the economy look back on that and almost to a person realize that that was incredibly harmful. You do not recover from depression by destroying things of value and raising the cost of what's left for everybody who has to buy them.
Yes, John, do people of your age bracket, do your colleagues, do they romanticize about FDR do they look back on FDR and spit on the ground?
Well, I did for a long time, including my father, who was a railroad worker. But you must remember that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was also probably the best wartime president we ever had, created also the greatest Ponzi scheme known to man, and that's the Social Security system.
Yeah.
Indeed he did. John, appreciate your insights. 303-713-8585. Before we grab more calls, let me also ask you about this term that I hear so often called packing the courts. We hear that FDR packed the courts, and he really changed how the courts interfered. My impression, and correct me please, is that before that we had a very strict constitutional system of courts. After FDR, we had a much more interpretive, living and breathing constitution as dictated by the courts. What does packing the courts mean in the layman's terms?
That phrase originated with FDR's attempt to pack the Supreme Court in particular in 1937, John. This was just after his re-election in 1936. He was quite angry with the court. He referred to them as those nine old men because in his first term they had thrown out some of the most harmful of New Deal legislation that he had pushed. And so now he wanted to get even and try to control the court. But, you know, you can't...
With what mechanism could he, quote, pass the courts?
Well, you can't just impeach them because they disagree with you. So he had to come up with a scheme. He proposed to the Congress that for every justice who reaches the age of 70 and who does not voluntarily retire, the president gets to appoint one new one. And at that time, if that had passed, it would have allowed him to pack the Supreme Court with five brand-new justices. And unfortunately, his own party turned against him on that and didn't approve it. But for several months in 1937, as that hung over us, it was a disincentive for people to invest because it was clear that if he got the kind of Supreme Court he wanted, then a lot of that harmful New Deal stuff would come back with a vengeance.
And also, it ran shudders through the court, or let me try a different way. It scared the members of the court because they realized that as they were getting older, he might come and change them, and that also changed the way they behave, and they became much more friendly to his policies. Do I understand that part correctly?
That's right. In the second Roosevelt term and the third, you do see the court moving more in his direction. And, of course, there were some vacancies that came about naturally, and he appointed new ones. And really, over the course of his presidency, he substantially changed the tenor and the tone of the court and its rulings, all in the direction of supporting of massive government intervention in the economy.
And those things haven't changed. Here in Colorado, Roy Romer, a very effective, I mean that effective that he was able to get his policies through, governor, had the same problems with the court here in Colorado, the Supreme Court, and got past a mandatory retirement age of, I believe, 72 for people on the Colorado Supreme Court. So you're up to 72, and you're out. All right, need to take another quick breather. 303-713-8585. Larry Reed with me. I'm John Caldera, News Radio 850 KOA. 35 minutes after 10 o'clock, in for Mike Rosen. I'm John Caldera. I am loving this conversation. Larry Reed is a good friend of mine. He's also the head of the Foundation for Economic Education. You should go to the website. It's a terrific organization. It's FEE.org. And Larry's written a lot on the Great Depression and the myths of the Great Depression. It's stunning for me to see the parallels of what Obama is doing now during what I think is a pretty sizable economic shift and what FDR did. And I worry that we are going to compliment this man and immortalize this man as he makes the problems worse here. Does history bear me out on this one?
Well, it could very well happen, John. There's no question about it that the economy, 8 years after Roosevelt took office, was still very, very deep in depression. We've only touched on what he did with taxes, but we should point out that he took the top income tax bracket, which Hoover had already more than doubled in 1932, and raised it further all the way up in the vicinity of 90%, and actually tried to get a 96% top income tax bracket. Congress would not give it to him.
Larry, he was only trying to spread the wealth. I don't like the way you're trying to portray this.
Well, let me tell you how he wanted to spread it. When Congress turned down the 96% income tax bracket he proposed, then he turned right around and by executive order imposed a 100% income tax on all citizens, or all income, I should say, above $25,000. Now, fortunately, that didn't stick very long because Congress overrode it. But if FDR had his way...
How could any president do that with an executive order?
Well, yeah, there would have been very grave constitutional questions about that had it allowed to stick. But Congress did override it. But you can see what he was driving for. He wanted to take every penny that anybody earned over $25,000. Now, how on earth anybody could think that that would help a depressed economy is beyond me, but that's what he tried to do.
Grab some of these phone calls, 303-713-8585. Let's head up to Boulder. Richard, glad to have you on News Radio 850 KOA.
Thank you for having me, gentlemen. I have just two things. One is an opinion, and after I'm through with that, let's have a pause, and then I'll go into something anecdotal. It is my firm belief that Franklin Delano Roosevelt didn't do anything plus or minus economically to get us out of the Depression and get us rolling again. What he did to get us going was to get us into the Second World War by his stunt with the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. So here's a pause, and I'd like you to get back to me and rebut. But here's an anecdotal.
Let's grab it one at a time so we don't, we don't forget it. So you're asserting that he really didn't do anything positively or negatively to affect the economy?
Larry, no, to get us out of the doldrums that we were in.
Larry, what do you think?
Well, I have to give FDR a little bit of credit for one thing. He did work to bring down tariff rates late in the decade of the 30s, just before the war, and that was helpful. And we really got some substantial tariff relief late in the war.
Why was that helpful?
Well, because it revived trade. It opened the channels of commerce. It allowed for industries dependent upon international commerce to reopen and to start trading again.
So not only did it allow us to buy products at a lesser price so we could be more productive with it, but our manufacturing, because tariffs are usually reciprocated, allowed us to send our stuff out.
Exactly. In 1944, while he was still in office, we got the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which began to bring down barriers by plan across the world, and that was very helpful. So I give him a little bit of credit for that. But by and large, what the caller is saying is correct. He did very little to get us out. We were still in it on the eve of World War II. I might quarrel with the supposition that it was the war, per se, that got us out of the Depression. In fact, I would quarrel with that.
But, why so?
Well, because warfare represents a diversion of resources and a destruction of resources. It isn't the road to economic recovery. But it often brings what appears to be recovery simply because of the way it's financed. We got a reinflation of the monetary system, more expansionary monetary policy that gave us a lift, of course, at the expense of the currency. But nonetheless, we got a short-term lift. But we really didn't get much recovery until FDR was gone, and we had a more business-friendly Truman administration after the war.
Richard?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay, second thing. This is anecdotal. I was born in 1933 and in Chicago, born and raised in Chicago, and my parents lived in quite an affluent area on the south side, believe it or not, called Beverly Hills. Nobody's ever heard of it. But we lived right across from what was called the Dan Ryan's Woods. This was a county park, and I don't remember this personally, but my parents told me about this. Around our house was a chain link fence, so my mother could put me out there and not worry about me, just check up on me every once in a while. And the story goes, I would go down to the front fence, put my hands up, and look through the fence at these guys who were digging trenches, digging and filling them up again, and back and forth day after day. And they really liked me because they would put on little shows for me and come over and show me how to use a shovel and how to use a pick and all this stuff.
But you actually remember them literally?
I do not personally remember. These are stories from my parents.
All right.
They would see me down there.
No, I don't use the term hiring people to dig ditches and fill them back in. Larry, is that a figure of speech or is that something more literal?
Oh, no, it actually happened, and there were crazier programs than that. As part of the WPA, Works Progress Administration, and some of the other alphabet agencies that Roosevelt created. If you want to read about these, there's a fantastic recent work just published by Simon & Schuster within the past month, a new book by Dr. Burton Folsom, F-O-L-S-O-M. It's called New Deal or Raw Deal, and he goes through many such examples of this waste and abuse of tax dollars. That's the other side of these make-work projects that often doesn't make it into the history books.
But it sure feels good.
Yeah, exactly.
Richard, appreciate the call. Thank you for
calling. Have a great holiday, guys.
303-713-8585. Let's head out to the Springs. Phil, you're on News Radio 850 KOA. Glad to have you.
Thank you. My story is, these are my parents' stories. I don't know. They said if it wasn't for FDR, they would have lost their farm because he retired their interest loan payments. Is that true? Or?
Well, hang on a second, because the parallel there is pretty amazing, because what I'm hearing from both presidential candidates was that we're going to now restructure people's loans so they don't lose their homes.
Right.
So
right.
If you've agreed to this contract and for whatever reasons you don't fulfill your side of it, government now is going to get in the middle of two private parties, you and your lender, and dictate that one side of them changes the way they do things. That is, lower your interest, lower your payments, make it work. So Larry, did this actually happen back then as well?
Yeah, it's entirely possible that because of some of the subsidies and programs for agriculture in the 30s, that this farm here or that farm there actually was allowed to stay in business. But that's not the same as saying that he revived the economy, because every dollar diverted to saving or bailing out this or that business or farm is a dollar that isn't available for someone to freely spend and stimulate other businesses. So, again, it's like that example I gave earlier of a thief who robs the neighborhood and then spends all the loot at the shopping mall. You can't look at just the stores that where he spends the money and say this guy's a public benefactor. You have to look at at all the diversions away from where the money would have been spent in the first place. Agriculture was in terrible shape in the 30s, but largely because of the tariff, the Smoot-Hawley tariff that was passed in 1930 under Herbert Hoover, and the massive tax increases of 1932 and beyond.
How much, I look back on the films, you're listening to Woody Guthrie songs, you look back at the Dust Bowl, and it seemed as though it was this perfect storm of economic collapse and then bad policy. Of course, historians will never admit that it was bad policy because FDR is so beloved. And then also the weather. Did the Dust Bowl, did we really hit a bad patch of weather during those years, or is that just something that fills our minds because we look at old black and white films?
Oh, I think it's the latter. We have bad weather all the time, but the problem was that because of the Smoot-Hawley tariff of 1930, there were hundreds of thousands of farmers in bankruptcy who walked off the farm, land was idle, and that allowed for typical storms we get in any season anyway to do a lot more damage than if the land had been tilled and cared for.
Let me see if I understand you, because fields were left alone, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, they were fallow, or we just didn't have farmers taking care of it and irrigating or otherwise farming and using the land productively. So idle land is an opportunity for the wind and for other storms to do some real damage. We had literally several million farmers who just walked off the farms in bankruptcy after the 1930 Smoot-Hawley tariff.
Because they couldn't send their food out? How did help me understand, how did the tariff hurt farmers?
Well,
it seems that if what it meant is, if tariffs mean that they couldn't buy their shovels because the prices of shovels that were imported went up, but explain to me the mechanism.
No, it was not so much because of the price of what they bought. In 1930, Congress passed and Hoover signed into law the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which raised tariffs to an all-time high and virtually closed the borders. And what that meant was that foreigners could no longer sell here because our high tariffs. But when they can't sell here, then they can't earn the dollars that they need to buy here. And about a third of what American farmers had been producing before 1930 was sold in overseas markets. And with the stroke of the presidential pen, the Smoot-Hawley tariff simply wiped out those foreign markets. So farmers all of a sudden,
okay, so
yeah, they couldn't say you can't.
So in other words, if I'm a foreign, if I buy your crops, and you don't, well, I sell you things, I now get money, and I can use that money to do all sorts of other things. But if you don't let me sell you my goods, the countries outside the United States, it starts a chain reaction. And that chain reaction is these foreigners don't have the money to do things like buy my grain.
Exactly. And then our high tariff here stimulated a retaliatory drive across the world. You had foreign governments doing the same thing to us, raising their tariffs on American goods. And so that's why you see these old newsreels of farmers dumping perfectly good milk into the ditches or drowning baby chicks because prices had plummeted and they couldn't raise them to maturity at a profit.
And you can thank the tariffs for that.
Oh, absolutely. Raised tariffs to an all-time high, closed the borders virtually, and so we were drowning in stuff we couldn't sell. Prices plummeted and drove farmers out of business.
And now we have massive subsidies going to farmers, not only in direct ways, but also in indirect corporate welfare for things like ethanol, which keeps corn growing, but not for food.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that barely a decade ago, Congress passed a law to end subsidies to agriculture, and here we are today spending more on those subsidies than we ever have before.
Ted up to Estes Park, 303-713-8585. Jim, you're with John Caldera, News Radio 850 KOA.
Good morning. How are you all?
Just fine.
Good morning.
I called because I read a letter to the editor this morning in the paper, Longmont paper, and it's about how Obama wants to invest $100 billion in wind, solar, energy efficiency, in public transit, et cetera.
Feels and good, doesn't it?
It sounds great, but you just mentioned a little bit ago that $100 billion has to be taken from somebody, and so it's no longer going to be used to create other jobs, and it's just pandering to me.
Yeah, you know, I have an old phrase that's not original with me, but I use it a lot. Government has nothing to give anybody except what it first takes from somebody. And a government that is big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you've got.
And governments don't produce wealth. People do. And that bothers me. Ironically, I just hiked by an old CCC camp that was established by Roosevelt up in Rocky Mountain National Park. And that's another example.
Well, here in Colorado, we've got a lot of kind of WPA-type things. You look at a lot of the dams, a lot of these public works that we look at that with some measure of nostalgia.
Trail Ridge Road.
Trail Ridge Road, the highest paved road in the United States. We look at this and go, man, you know, if it wasn't for FDR and his vision to make these things happen, we wouldn't have these things today. You see, Larry, if we didn't have FDR, we wouldn't have built this great infrastructure of roads, of bridges, of dams, and that's all Obama said he wants to do as well.
And what scares me is Obama is going to be so popular that he could be reelected, and you know, any harm he does won't show up for 5 or 6 years from now.
Well, if he's treated like FDR, they will never show up. So let me ask you, Larry, now I got to take a break, but if FDR built all these wonderful things, why was it a bad deal? Why was it bad to build all these roads?
Well, you know, if you concede that government has certain core functions, and roads and bridges and dams may be among them, I mean, those things may serve a purpose in and of themselves, but to think of them as stimulating the economy or as a means to stimulate the economy ignores the fact that they are essentially redistributive. I mean, yeah, when you have a road built from here to there, you know, there's some good that comes from it, but don't assume that somehow that the spending for that road provided some magic stimulus or that it was sort of free, as if the money came from nobody.
And certainly the camp that, Jim, you went to today up in Estes Park, which was a CCC camp, what was the economic stimulus from that? It's not like too many things were passed along on that road. Hey, I got to take a quick breather. 303-713-8585. John Caldera, News Radio 850 KOA. 6 minutes past 10 o'clock. Let's try that again. 6 minutes till 11 o'clock. I'm John Caldera. Larry Reed's with me. Larry runs the Foundation for Economic Education. Great organization. Go to it. FEE.org. Get on their mailing list. It's one of those great warehouses of knowledge. We've got a lot of calls here, but Larry, let me ask you about that. Films and books like Grapes of Wrath. I hear somebody famous wrote a book called it, but I saw the movie because I don't know how to read. And the image there was of that of kind of this socialist propaganda. And I don't know, how was it that FDR was able to promote so many different aspects of socialism, of great regulatory interference, and still be hailed as this great defender of capitalism? And talk to me a little bit about the imagery that we've seen since then.
You know, it's so captivating to see people in dire straits. How can your heart not go out to them? And government in those situations, of course, seems to offer an instant solution. We're just going to give them something. But deeper thinkers are pointing out such things as, hey, what caused the problem in the first place? Maybe we ought to fix the fundamentals. What are the downsides to government programs that mortgage the next generation? So it's really infantile to simply look at what government spends and say, here's the visible, here's what strikes the eye, how can you be opposed to it? I can see the good things it's doing. It's infantile to not assess things like the long term and the effects on all people, the precedents that are set, and the fundamentals that are being ignored and perpetuating the problem.
Grab a couple calls if we can squeeze them in. Linda, we're tight on time. You're on News Radio 850 KOA.
Yes, my aunt had a farm, and she was so angry with Adlai Stevenson because he had them kill their baby pigs so that they could inflate the price of pork.
How did he have them kill the pigs?
He said, kill your baby pigs, and we will give you, you know, a little extra money. Or
in other words, in order to get the subsidy, you need to reduce your production. And if your production is too high, you don't. And you talk about a remarkable disincentive. You know, the idea that we should stop producing, we'll get money not to produce. Larry, how does that work?
Well, by the way, that was Henry Wallace, not Adlai Stevenson. But
oh, I thought it was Adlai Stevenson.
No, Henry Wallace, Secretary of Agriculture, in one order, he ordered the destruction of 6 million baby pigs. The idea there was, well, if we reduce supply, then the price will go up. And when the price goes up, the farmer, of course, will make more money somehow. But the problem is, you've got less to sell on after the supply is destroyed. And even if you make more money, you can make it only at the expense of everybody else. This meant that there were fewer pigs for people for consumption, and that any higher prices the farmer got were offset by the higher prices that people had to pay.
Am I finding the one instance where if PETA were around back then and effective, it would have been good for capitalism?
Yeah, they probably would have raised the fuss, and rightly so.
Linda, I appreciate the call. Larry, we've only got a minute or so left. Wrap this up for me. Give me something that I can sink my teeth into. As I'm seeing comparisons between FDR and Obama and the image of FDR saving us from the Great Depression, what is it that we really need to know as we're looking forward? What do we need to know from the past as we look forward?
We need to understand that today's stimulus, and that's in quotes, is tomorrow's burden. That when we add to the tax burden or to the debt burden because we think that somehow it will help things for the moment, all we're doing is adding to our burdens later. We'll pay the price in higher prices through inflation or higher debt. It's short-term thinking, and surely we don't want to pass on that kind of a legacy to the next generation. Americans are too focused on the short run, the here and now, what pleases this or that special interest group. They're not focused on the long run, the future, and the health of the economy in the next generation.
But what you're missing is, last time we did something on this grand a scale, history rewarded that president and rewarded those actions by a favorable grade afterwards.
That's right. There's nothing about democracy that says that the people will always make the right decisions. There are many cases in history where people have voted themselves into slavery.
People want to get in more information about this. I know you've done some terrific work. How best to do it?
Go to www.cfee.org.
Again, that's the Foundation for Economic Education, a spectacular organization. Larry Reed, thank you for joining us. I hope you have a terrific turkey day. This was more than educational for me.
Hey, thank you, John. Happy Thanksgiving.
Back after news. Keep it here. You're on News Radio 850 KOA.